Jason in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. I'm not a numbers guy, although I was a fan of the short-lived CBS TV show by that name. You might even call me mathophobic, if there is such a thing. The only reason I wasn't a chemistry major in college was the calculus requirement, so I majored in history instead, and look where that got me. Well, actually, that turned out pretty well. But I say that to say this. You don't have to be a mathematics lover to or an expert to love a good mystery, particularly a good mystery that involves the origin of numbers. Do you know where our numbers come from? Do you know who discovered the zero or where it came from? Do you know why that was so important? Well, those are some questions we'll answer this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Joining me is Amir Akzal, internationally renowned writer on mathematics and author of 15 books, including The Riddle of the Compass, The Mystery of the Aleph, and the international bestseller Fermat's Last Theorem. His latest book is titled Finding Zero, A Mathematician's Odyssey to Uncover the Origins of Numbers, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Amir Akzal, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on the show.
Your fascination with mathematics, with numbers, began at a very early age. Let's start with that. Tell our listeners, please, about your childhood and how you first became interested in numbers.
Well, I had a very unusual childhood. My father was a ship's captain for a cruise ship, just like The Love Boat, for anybody who remembers that program. And it was just a dream, you know, living on a ship, being the captain's son. And the ship used to go and travel in the Mediterranean. They did Mediterranean cruises, and one of the most favored port of call was Monte Carlo. And the adults on the ship would go to the casino and gamble. And as a child, I wasn't allowed. But this was like the height of the cruise. You know, there's no onboard gambling in those days. And everybody talked about it. And one time, a steward from the ship, my father's steward, smuggled me into the casino. And what I saw there were numbers on the roulette wheel. And I was a very young child, and these numbers just were impressed in my memory with this amazing fascination, you know, colored numbers in red and black on a green tabletop there in a casino with people dressed very fancily gambling. And that was just something that started me in my career as a mathematician. You mentioned chemistry, so I studied chemistry too, but I was so attracted to numbers that I changed to a major from chemistry to math, and later on statistics too, because of the probabilities that is all, which is gambling is all about.
Yeah. Well, my other problem with chemistry is that I tend to do chemistry the way I cook, a little of this, a little of that, and let's see what happens, which is not what you want in the laboratory. So you were interested in numbers at a very early age, fascinated by them. How did that manifest itself in school? I mean, were you always the first one done with the arithmetic problems, that kind of thing?
Well, I was one of those who were good with math early on. But the fascination with the numbers was sort of more of a historical thing that was a hobby. So while I was pursuing a career as a mathematician and statistician, I was also interested in the numbers in a historical sense. And that's really what I write about in this book. So there's less math in it than earlier books. It's really the search for the origin of numbers. And in my childhood, I was exposed to this idea of searching for something, because the ship had these cruises, historical cruises, too, where people were you know, learning about the history of Greece and Rome. And that's what really fascinated me in this respect, looking for the origins of the numbers, where they came from.
Well, you mentioned your father's steward on the ship, and he was a pretty influential person in your early life, was he not?
Right. He was my math tutor. And in the book, I trace the story of me finding out other things about what he was. He really gave me this love of numbers. I really owe him a lot for that.
So despite... Why is it so important to know where our numbers came from? I mean, I doubt if most people ever think about it. We look at the numbers. I have several computer screens in front of me, and they all have numbers all over them. We all recognize what these numbers are. We kind of take them for granted. We don't really think too much about them. Why is it important for us to know where they came from and how we got them?
Because our numbers are very, very special. The Romans had a number system that we know very well because, you know, your watches and clocks sometimes have Roman numerals. But trying to do arithmetic with these Roman numerals is very, very difficult. I would challenge anybody to multiply MMM, CC, CX, XII or something like that by the number that looks like that. It's very, very hard. And the reason is that they didn't have a zero. Our numbers are so fascinating, and that goes back to the casino in Monte Carlo. The most special number there was a zero, which was alone in green on the roulette table. And the zero is really what makes our numbers work. Without a zero, we couldn't do it arithmetic the way we do it. The computer that you're staring at would not work without the existence of a zero. In fact, the computer inside works with just zeros and ones, as everybody knows. So the invention of zero, and with it the nine other numerals that we use, is such an immense intellectual advance of civilization that it in my mind, it merited trying to find the origins of.
In your book, you describe number systems from a number of cultures around the world. I mean, human development happened all over the globe. You talk about numbers that were used by the Mayans, I believe. You talk about where the Greeks got theirs from the Egyptians and so forth. Talk about some of these other numbering systems and what was unique about them and how they worked.
So the Maya were really the first to discover zero around the first century A.D. And what they did was to use a glyph that looked like a crescent moon in computations that were used for within their calendar. They had several calendars, and one of them is pretty interesting because it had a base 20 and another base together to give them 360 days for the year, which is close to the 365. Then they had another calendar with another number of days for various things. One was based on Venus, and they had several calendars. And the zero there was the point where the calendar reset itself to start from the beginning, counting the days, such as the days of the year, day one, two, and so until 360, and then set back to zero. So they understood that they needed the zero, but that zero didn't go anywhere. It remained in Mesoamerica. And the zero that I was after in this book was the zero that became our zero of the Hindu Arabic numerals, as we call them. One of the interesting systems that you alluded to in terms of other number systems is the Babylonian. The Babylonians didn't have a zero, excuse me, but they did have... they would leave an empty space to indicate a zero, and then you'd have to use your understanding of the context to determine whether there was a zero there or not. For example, to use a modern example, you might say, if you say somebody says it costs $6.95, you'd understand it to be $6.95 if you're buying a magazine, but $695 if you're buying an airplane ticket. So the Babylonians had to use this kind of deduction all the time because they didn't have a zero. Their system was actually fascinating because it's based on 60 rather than 10. So if you think of our system having the numbers, just the units, and then you go to powers of 10, like say 40 is 4 of the first power of 10, and 400 would be 4 of the second power of 10, and so on. The Babylonians used base 60 so that you'd have the units, and then the 60s that you have there would be the first power of 60, and 3600 would be the second power of 60. So it's a very strange, very large base. And that's probably the most interesting number system, but it didn't have a zero. Then, as you mentioned, there's the Egyptian system, and the Greeks and the Romans used letters for numbers.
Yeah, Letters for Numbers. You spend some time talking about that in your book and what that meant. But what I'm interested in, I guess I was thinking about, you know, the Egyptians and the Babylonians, for that matter, and the Greeks later, and then the Romans. They built some pretty large engineering projects. I mean, the pyramids, the Sphinx, the temples in Egypt, and so forth. That kind of engineering requires a lot of mathematics. How were they able to do it without the zero?
That's a really excellent question and a fascinating idea, and I have no answer to that. We know that their math was pretty clunky because of the absence of zero, and we do know that their engineering feats were incredible. If you go to Italy or anywhere in the Mediterranean and see a road that's very straight, you couldn't build such a road as straight today. You know, it's a Roman road. The Roman roads were, you know, like a ruler. They were so straight. And the Pantheon, built 2,000 years ago and still standing in Rome, they did have their aqueducts everywhere in Europe that the Romans built for transporting water. And of course, the pyramids in Egypt. These are excellent examples. And I don't think... Well, I do have an idea of how they did it. They had slaves, and the slaves could sit around all day making, you know, doing count computations in a system that was very inefficient. So they had these people who did their calculations for them. But today, our calculations are much easier, and a child in school can learn how to multiply large numbers because our system is so efficient. Their number system was not efficient, but they used it well because they needed to.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're discussing the book Finding Zero, A Mathematician's Odyssey to Uncover the Origins of Numbers. And this is really an adventure story. If I had to categorize it, that's how I would categorize it in the library. I'd put it in the adventure section because I want to get to the adventures that you had while you were looking for zero. It was quite a trip you took, and you made a lot of discoveries along the way, had a lot of experiences, and I'd like you to share some of those with us. I don't want you to try to share all of them. We only have 40 minutes left of the program, and, you know, you'd also like people to buy the book. But I want to hear some of those stories about what it was like when you set off on your quest to find zero and what was involved in that. Anyway, I'd like to know what our audience thinks. If you have questions for our guest about the importance of numbers, about the importance of zero. Maybe you're a mathematician and you'd like to make a contribution here. What have your assumptions been about numbers? I mean, we talk about Arabic numerals. Well, you know, where did they come from? We probably all have a lot of assumptions about numbers, and many of them, like most assumptions, have problems. But ask questions. That's what we're here for. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Amir Aksal is my guest. He is a writer on mathematics. He's authored 15 books, and this is his most recent, Finding Zero. We're talking to him on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about numbers, specifically the number zero. Title of the book under discussion is Finding Zero, A Mathematician's Odyssey to Uncover the Origins of Numbers. We have its author with us, Amir Aksal, who is also the best-selling author of Fermat's Last Theorem and a whole bunch of other books about math. This is more of an adventure story than a discussion of mathematical theory. And we have callers and questions and so forth. Lots of people want to be involved. We'll get to those in just a moment. We had an email from Tony who asked, "Did Descartes come up with zero?" Descartes, D-E-S-C-A-R-T-E-S. Descartes? I'm probably mispronouncing. But did Descartes come up with zero?
Sure, of course. Descartes was born in 1596 and died in 1650. The zero came to Europe in 1202 with Fibonacci. Yes, Descartes, of course, used zero. He had equations with zero at the end. He actually solved some very interesting equations. That was his contribution to mathematics, among other things. So, in 1202, Fibonacci, the guy from the series, from the sequence 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, and 13, and so on, the famous sequence that even appeared in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. That guy wrote a book called The Art of the Book of the Abacus, and in it he introduced the Hindu-Arabic numbers into Europe. So the Europeans used the Roman numbers until the 13th century, until 1202 when the book came out. It didn't happen immediately. The Hindu-Arabic numerals came into Europe slowly over several decades, starting in 1202.
And the numbers that we use today that we call Arabic numerals, they don't those have changed over time. I mean, they don't look, they're not the same if we go to the Middle East or if we go to India. The numbers don't look the same.
Right, that's what I find so interesting. In fact, so Fibonacci learned these numbers from the Arab traders. His father was a big merchant who traded, would go to North Africa and trade with Arabs, and he learned from, and his son, who was a mathematician, learned from them these numbers, which he called Arabic, but even in his book he notes that there are the nine Hindu numerals and the zeros. So we call them Arabic numerals or Hindu-Arabic, because even early on, when Fibonacci brings them to Europe, there is the understanding that they originate in India. And in fact, part of my adventures was going to India and trying to look for the earliest numerals there. Not the zero yet, but the just the numerals. And there are several scripts in India. The seven is interesting. That appears early on to be identical to our seven. And the other numerals change their form as we go through time. The Arabs, for example, use a dot for a zero. And we use a circle, and the Arabs use a circle in the Arabic numbers is a five. So there are several forms of these numerals, and in India, in the book, in fact, I show some early Indian Hindu numerals, so they're quite different from ours. So the forms did change, but this is really the same number system, whether mm-hmm. we call it Hindu or Hindu-Arabic or Arabic. It really comes from India by way of Arab trade. But the zero, of course, has a slightly different story, as I describe in the book.
Well, yeah, and I want to get to that. We have some callers. Let's take Brian from Madison first. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering when and if you know who first came up with negative numbers.
Right, that's a really good question. Negative numbers require the zero as an understanding, so that comes later after the discovery of zero. Although, actually, I should correct that. The Chinese used negative numbers without really an explicit zero. There's a book called The Nine Chapters on the Mathematical Arts, which is a very early Chinese manuscript. I forget its date, but the first few centuries, A.D., B.C., around that time, and it does have negative numbers and positive numbers without a zero. Mathematically, today, we define the negative numbers as reflection through zero, if you will, and on the other, the axis reflects through zero to the right, and I'm sorry, to the left, to make the negative numbers. So algebraically, we need a zero, but the Chinese could understand negative numbers very early on without a zero. So
you really can't imagine numbers less than one. How would you get a fraction of one without having some other? I guess I'm thinking about it as like boundaries between different expressions. So if you're less than one, but it's not a negative number, there's got to be some place there where we get to zero. Maybe I'm not being clear there. But.
Yeah, you can define them as sequences approaching zero, like 1 over n. N goes to infinity, approaches zero. So the idea of a zero is pretty interesting. And through my research, I came to believe that it's an Eastern idea, the mm-hmm. whole idea of a zero.
How did you come to that belief?
Yeah, that's a good question. I studied the. I was, first of all, I was stunned by the fact that there's no zero in Europe until, you know, the 13th century. And that's really shocking when you start to think about it. There's
well,
no idea
they didn't, zero. They didn't believe in bathing until about then either. So,
right.
You know, let's make a list of the things that were shocking about 13th century Europe. That would be another one.
Right, yeah. So, and in the East, you do have, in Buddhism, you have the idea of a void. And what really gave me the idea that there must be a connection between zero and the Buddhist void was the fact that the word is pretty much the same. In India, to say zero, you say shunya or sunya. And the void that Buddhists use in their meditation is called shunyata or sunyata. So it's really pretty much the same word. The void is the zero. So, and if you read and go through, you know, Buddhist, Jain, and Hindu literature, you see that the ideas of zero, a void, and infinity as a very large number, well, infinity, are more prevalent there than in the West. In the West, we until really the 18th the 19th century, the idea of infinity wasn't well developed. It was developed by Georg Cantor, a German mathematician, with a very rigorous mathematical foundation. But in the East, they talked about infinity and about the void and zero much, much earlier.
Let's take a phone call from Rich in Rhinelander now. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. I was hoping your guest could comment on algebra, which uses alphabetic symbols as well as numeric, and I'm certain that its very name, algebra, suggests that we have a debt to Islamic societies. And I also wondered if your guest studied the Chinese and any numeric systems they had, because their civilizations seem to predate much of what we in the West consider early civilizations.
Rich, thanks so much for that question. Amir Aksal?
Right. So algebra comes from the title of a book, Al-Jabr wal-Muqabila, by a person by the name of Al-Khwarizmi, who lived in the Middle Ages and actually was in Central Asia and moved to Baghdad. There was something there called the House of Wisdom in the Caliphate in Baghdad, and he wrote this very influential book that started algebra, and he does give us equations. Now, equations were known to the Greeks, even quadratic equations. Diophantus in Alexandria, about the year 200 AD or so, understood some equations, but Al-Khwarizmi. And by the way, the word algorithm comes from Al-Khwarizmi. So if you say Al-Khwarizmi very fast, it sounds like algorithm. So we get two words, algebra from the title of his book, and algorithm comes from his name, this amazing mathematician. So he put the book Al-Jabr wal-Muqabila is a book that has a lot of systematic ways of solving equations, and we do owe it to the Arabs. Of the Middle Ages, the whole algebra, even though it was begun by the Greeks. As for Chinese, there's a book I mentioned earlier, the nine chapters on the mathematical arts, and there are other Chinese manuscripts that are pretty are written pretty early on. The Chinese used the abacus, and today, even if you you go to a Chinese market in China or in other places in Asia, you can see that they can do their calculations on an abacus faster than you can do them on a calculator. Yes, they had very advanced mathematics. There's nothing that I found about zero explicitly there, but as we talked about earlier, a lot of good mathematics was done throughout civilization, different civilizations, without the use of zero. Our system is very efficient, but math can be done without it too.
800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Rich, thanks for your call. We welcome your comments or questions for our guest, Amir Aksal, who is the author of the book, Finding Zero. We're talking about his quest. And so there was a great deal of debate among mathematicians in the 20th century and in the early 1930s about where zero came from and who either discovered it or invented it. What were the various positions? You talk about that a little bit in your book. Why did it matter so much to people to determine where the zero came from or who invented it?
Well, the zero is an incredible invention because it allows our numbers to cycle. This is why we can use just the nine signs, 1 through 9, and the zero to write any number, while the Roman numerals would grow and grow. And we can ours are very efficient, and it is just an immense intellectual achievement, and people wanted to claim credit for it. So there was a British scholar by the name of G.R.K., who in the first few decades of the 20th century until 1931 claimed that the zero, this keystone of the whole number system that we use, came from the West or from the Arabs and then traveled east. He was just very biased and racist. And I have to say that because he was an expert on India. In fact, had access to very pretty important documents in India, the Bakshali manuscript. He was the first scholar to be able to look at it, and that's a mathematical manuscript that's extremely important in the history of mathematics. It's at the Bodleian Library in Oxford right now. And Kay came to the conclusion that that everything was invented in the West and brought to India and not the other way around, which we know today was very wrong. So the question is, if you sort of imagine a map of the world in your mind, and you see Europe in the West, then there's the Arab world in between, and today's Middle East, and then you go further east, there's India and Southeast Asia, which enters my story at some point. So the question is, where did this zero, which is so important for us, where did it begin? If you view the Arab trade as connecting East and West, which it did through the Middle Ages, then according to Kay, the numbers and the zero could have come from West to East or from East to West, or could have been invented by the Arabs, especially the zero, and moved then both East and West, because the Arabs were the traders at some period of time, connecting East and West. And there was another scholar by the name of George Cedes, C-O-E-D-E-S, who was French and was a genius with languages. Apparently he was good with mathematics too, even though he didn't know it. And he started as a German teacher in Paris, and then one day went to the museum and he noticed that he could translate steles and inscriptions from Old Khmer and from Sanskrit into French. And he was amazed by his own ability. He got a doctorate in ancient languages, and he traveled to Hanoi in today's Vietnam and Bangkok, and he lived there most of his life, and he translated thousands of these inscriptions. And at some point, he became obsessed with the idea, as I reflect with my obsession many years later with this book. He became obsessed with the idea of proving that the zero was an Eastern invention and not a Western one or an Arab one. So what he did is he searched all these steles that he could find in Cambodia especially, but also in Thailand and Vietnam and Myanmar. And he found one with a very early zero. Now, I should add some context to this. The earliest zero in India is from the mid-9th century, and it's in a place called Gwalior, G-W-A-L-I-O-R, which is southeast of Agra, where the Taj Mahal is. And in that city, there's a temple to the Hindu god Vishnu, which has a zero because it describes that there are 270 hasta, which is a unit of area used by the Indians of that time, dedicated to this temple. And the zero is exactly like our zero. It's a circle. and it dates to the year about middle of the 9th century, 850 or so A.D. So the problem was that this zero is at the same time as this flourishing Arab trade, and therefore it could have been brought there, the idea of a zero from the West, by Arab traders, or it could have started there and brought to the West from there. So Kay argued against this zero, saying, well, it could have originated anywhere. So what Sedes, the French guy living in Southeast Asia, was trying to do is to find an earlier zero. And he set out to do that, and he did. He found a zero that is 200 years earlier, before the Arab trading empire centered in Baghdad. And that zero is from the year 683 A.D., so it's about almost 200 years earlier than the Gwalior zero, and it's much farther east, too, so it's much earlier and farther east, and that constituted definitive proof, as much as anybody could give, that the zero is an Eastern invention. So he published it in 1931, decimating this theory by Kay. Kay was very embarrassed, and eventually the world of science accepted that the zero is an Eastern invention. And then the stele bearing that number disappeared. And during the Khmer Rouge period, when Khmer Rouge thugs were destroying a lot of the art and artifacts in Cambodia, in a similar way to what the Taliban were doing in Afghanistan before 9/11 with those giant Buddha statues. The Khmer Rouge killed 1.7 million of their own people, Cambodians, and destroyed the art as well. So this stele disappeared completely, and I set out to try and find it.
Well, I want to hear all about that adventure. We also have a whole bunch of people who want to ask questions, and we need to take a break. So when I add all that up, that looks like I've got 10 pounds of rocks and a 5-pound bag here. So let's try and squeeze in what we can. This is an exciting story. The book is Finding Zero. Amir Aksel is the author of the book. He's with me, and a lot of other people are too. We'll get to those calls and comments and questions in just a moment. First, we're going to take a short time out. Let me give the phone number again, 800-486-8655. I'm sure we'll be opening up some lines in just a moment. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and this program is being broadcast on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about numbers, particularly the number zero. The book is Finding Zero, Mathematician's Odyssey to Uncover the Origins of Numbers. Amir Aksel is the author. He's with me, and a fascinating story. So the Khmer Rouge did away with all sorts of artifacts and artwork in Cambodia. The inscription that you described that shows an early use of zero disappears. What made you think that you could go find it?
That's a good question. I have no idea. It's just the belief that I didn't know that I would find it, but I wanted to find it, and I wanted to try and find it, and then I applied for a grant from the Sloan Foundation in New York, and my research was stalled for a while. I couldn't find it, and I couldn't find anything related to it. I went to India and looking for more hints about the zero. I could get nowhere, and then just about when I was ready to give up on this lifelong search, I got this grant which told me that the foundation believed that I could find the zero. And then I had to, because they trusted that I would find it. And so I guess I made an effort that was even beyond me, as I describe in the book, and I decided I had to find it. They believed that I should find it, and so I did. So it took a lot of research, writing people, calling people, begging and asking and pleading to find information.
You had some help from the Cambodian government along the way, but they
right.
basically said, well, we think it might be here, go look, and you were kind of on your own after that.
Right, exactly. So meeting this high government official in Cambodia, they call him His Excellency Hab Tush, and he's the official. He's a deputy minister of culture and fine arts, and he has been traveling around the world now trying to get museums in the West to return all the art that was stolen and sold in the markets during the time of the Khmer Rouge regime. And for some reason, he found the time to answer me. I have no idea why. He was so busy and with so many important things. But I think he believed in this project, too, and he said he made some phone calls that helped me. And that, as you said, that's what he did. He said, go to this place. This was the last known location, general location, where this artifact with the earliest zero from 86, 83, called K-127 is what Sedes, the number that Sedes gave it in his catalog. And it was brought here in 1969, before the time of the Khmer Rouge, which is in the mid-70s. Go look for it if you want to. And so talking to him opened doors that were very closed before, because the place where I finally found it is close to the public, and it's near the Temple of Angkor Wat in the area of Siem Reap in Cambodia.
And where is this artifact now?
Right now it's in a museum. It's back in a museum, and that goes beyond the book. So when the book ends, I find it after a very arduous search, looking through thousands of discarded artifacts in this clearing in the jungle there and outside Siem Reap. I find it, and as described in the book, there are other adventures that follow my discovery where other people try to steal it and take it away. The book ends with a promise from His Excellency Habtush that he will be reinstated in the museum. But then 2 years passed since that research was finished. I discovered K-127 on the 2nd of January 2013. And in the late afternoon, I'd been searching for it for about 2 days in that location. When I finally found it, I describe in the book emailing and trying to call His Excellency Habtush again to remind him that he agreed to put it back in the museum in Phnom Penh, where it belongs, where people can see. And after saying yes, he doesn't answer anymore for 2 years. And here's what happened after the book was finished then. So my sister was a big, but was very interested in Cambodia's history, and especially the Khmer Rouge regime. And she's the one who got me to Cambodia years ago in the first place. And she died without children or a husband, and I inherited a modest amount of money from her. And then I went back to the Cambodian government, and I said, I will pay for placing K-127 back in the museum where it had once been before 1969. In the 30s, it was in the museum. Then it was taken away and dumped in this place. The Khmer Rouge destroyed much of the art in the location where I actually found it in 2013. And the minute I mentioned money, they said, oh, sure, yeah, we'll put it in the museum.
Why am I not surprised? You know what? Somebody should be calling you about film rights, because this thing reads like an Indiana Jones kind of adventure. I think Hollywood would eat this up. Let's take some phone calls. Mike in Glendale is on the line. Mike, go ahead.
Sure. I just kind of wanted to hear maybe what the author had to say about how the concept of zero progressed, both the philosophical concept, the mathematical concept, and the maybe statistical concept. I mean, obviously, there were discussions by Plato and Aristotle about the absence of things, and that seems to me to be a discussion of, for instance, I've got two apples, I've eaten one of them, I've got one apple, I've eaten that one, now I have no apples. That concept existed, but the referential way of categorizing this thing in the form of a character, which we put down and use as a computational tool, that there was a flow there, both philosophical and then ultimately mathematical and then subsequently statistical, a concept of the null, and did he think about that as he was doing all of this?
Amir Excel?
Yes. Absolutely. This is a very, very important observation that you make. And in fact, it was in my mind throughout this research journey. And I write about it a lot in the book. I intersperse the travel adventure together with these philosophical musings about the zero. So you put it very well. In fact, the idea of, well, if you have two apples and then they're gone, there's nothing. The question is, can you call that nothing? Can you give it a name? And can you write it so this can be used in a computation? And that's the key here. So the idea that there's nothing, of course, is it's natural. If somebody takes away what you have, you have nothing. But the question is, can you call a nothing a thing? Can a nothing be a thing? And when a nothing becomes a thing that you can actually write down as a circle or a dot or something like that.
Well, not to be too philosophical about it, but if I eat the apples, I still have them technically. I just don't have them in my hand. I've moved them from one place to another. I've converted the apples from one thing to another thing, but the apples in theory still exist. Oh, I'm giving myself a headache. Let's go to Richard in Fox Lake next. Richard, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, John. Wonderful show. My question for Amir, excuse me, have you noticed any type of manifestations or appearances of human faces based on these linguistics? For example, I was doing some work with translating the word bread, which has the word reed in it, into the Bengali language, and that more or less manifests a type of a Mario apparition where this guy's got a facing west with a brim of a baseball cap, a mole under his pointy nose, a fish symbol for the lips, and like a French curl in the back of the cap is hair. Are these type of apparitions common in these language conversions, do you believe?
Well, so Sedeth, who discovered that first zero that we know, and by the way, 80 years later, after he wrote about it in 1931, it's still the earliest zero we know. So Sedeth studied also the earlier numerals in Cambodia and generally in Southeast Asia before the zero appears. And what he found was really fascinating and relates to what you're saying, even though it's not exactly the same thing. So the Cambodians the first few centuries A.D., before the zero arrives in 683 or maybe before that probably, but before they had the zero, they used names, and they are sort of, they have to do with human beings, as you pointed out, names for numbers. For example, to say the number 2 in early Cambodian script, you say eyes. So the word for 2 is eyes. The word for 4 is Vedas, and they were Hindu at the time. They changed from Hindu to Buddhist and back and forth. They were Hindu at the time, and the famous manuscripts of the holy books of the Hindu that appear very early on are called the 4 Vedas. So instead of saying the number 4, you say the Veda. Then there's the senses and the flavors. And so each word like that means a number. So it's in a way to say 42, they'd say Veda eyes. So these are all things that have to do with human beings, and they're names of things. They remind me of the phonetic alphabet, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and so on. These are names for letters, and what they used are names for numbers, words from everyday life, some having to do with people directly, like the eyes, to define numbers, and I think that's pretty fascinating.
Richard, thanks so much. Thanks so much for that call. I wanted to make sure I asked you this, and before we run out of time in the broadcast here today, what was that like for you when you discovered this artifact? You found it. You had done all of this searching. I mean, you spent a lot of time on this. You had invested, there were large sums of money involved. You had invested a lot of your time, and I would think your reputation in finding this artifact. So when you see it, and I'm assuming you held it in your hands when you saw it there, can you describe for us what that felt like when you found it?
It was immense euphoria. It was the greatest moment in my life, and I just didn't know what to do. And as you said, I invested so much in it. The grant was a small part of it. I'm pretty much in debt right now because I made trips to Cambodia afterwards to try to take it back from whoever took it. And the fact that it was stolen was actually having to do with my moment of euphoria. I took 5 years of very intense research to try and find it. When I found it, I stood there. I just was, I can't really describe it. I mean, I thought about it. I'll never have a moment like that in my life again. And actually touching it, I dare not touch it. I thought it was like so fragile. It's a big, you know, it's a rock about the size of a person. And I didn't dare touch it because I was so stunned by having found it. I didn't believe I would find it, actually. A lot of people who know about these things told me it's almost certainly destroyed by the Khmer Rouge or just lost. You won't find it. And when I found it, I did go by the numerals. I recognized these ancient numerals, and I saw them on that stele. And the fact that I could find it, it was just incredible. And then I talked about it too much. And somebody who was there, an Italian archaeologist, thought that it was so important that she's going to take it to her lab, and she did. But now it's back in a museum, and a French journalist who has been trailing after this K-127 ever since she read several articles that I wrote about it, wrote me an email a week ago saying that it's in the museum. I saw it there. They're now labeling it, and they'll display it when I give them money, of course, but it's in the museum.
That must give you a great deal of personal satisfaction to have been the person who really got that, made that possible.
Yes, it's probably the greatest thing I ever did. Yeah,
well, congratulations. Let's take another call, and this time we'll go to Middleton, where William is on the line. William, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, I guess you have to be aware of Munson. He's a kind of an interesting fella. He ought to know that the Finns came up with the word, the number zero, because the Finns have no body odor. They did take baths ever since thousands of years ago, back in Egypt even. They had the sauna, no smell. They had the number zero.
Okay. William, thanks for the call. Not sure what saunas and zeros have to do with each other, but William, thanks for joining us today. One of the questions that I've had, and I don't want to get into anything too deep here, we're right at the end of the broadcast, but one of the questions that I had, I've read various things saying the zero was invented. Some things say the zero was discovered. I guess that begs all sorts of philosophical discussions about, you know, did the zero exist before we knew about it? But did we invent the zero, or did we discover it?
That's probably the most fascinating question in the history of mathematics, and one that has obsessed me independently in the sense of this search for the zero. And so I've interviewed leading mathematicians, including five Fields medalists. So people probably know the Fields medal is the Nobel Prize of mathematics. And the question is, do numbers exist if there was no universe at all, or do they not exist? And that's a question that's not decided by anybody. Nobody can determine the answer. But most leading mathematicians, I would actually say all leading mathematicians I've talked to, believe in the Platonic idea, and that goes back to Plato, that numbers exist regardless of the universe. There is this milieu in heaven, if you will, where numbers exist and we discover them. Now the question is very philosophical and very deep, because what happens with something like Fermat's Last Theorem, and as you mentioned, this was probably my best-known book about the proof of this theorem that was written by Fermat 350 years before and solved in 1993-94 by Andrew Wiles at Princeton, now at Cambridge, or Oxford, went back to Britain. So the question is, when you have a theorem about numbers, are you discovering something about it, or are we inventing these numbers, and therefore we should know the theorem? And I think, from what I can tell, most mathematicians who are very good at it will tell you that numbers have an existence, and they describe making a proof of a theorem, like such as Fermat's Last Theorem, as discovering something that's there. They described it to me as a feeling. We have a feeling that there is something there that we're discovering. And if a good mathematician who spends his or her life trying to prove some theorem tells you that, then I tend to believe that that's the case. We're discovering. So, but going back to the zero, I would have to say the idea of zero probably exists regardless of humanity and the universe, the physical universe. But writing it down as a symbol you can call it an invention.
Well, maybe it's like gravity. You know, it's not important that you believe in gravity, but gravity believes in you. Thank you for an interesting discussion and a fascinating book. I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Amir Aksal is the author of the book Finding Zero, Mathematician's Odyssey to Uncover the Origins of Numbers. K.P. Whaley produced this hour of radio on the Ideas Network, and Lisa Nalbandian handled on-air production. Thanks so much to both of them. I'll be back tomorrow with another 2 hours of the Kathleen Dunn Show, so be sure to come on back for that. Central Time is up next. Stay tuned. I'm John Munson. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.